come back. You're having much too much fun. First of all, let me say how wonderful it is to see that quite a few of you have come out in the middle of this holiday season. 2 days after the solstice, the darkest time of the year. In Southeast Asia, these 3 months, December, January, and February, rains all the time. So the tradition is the monks all come in for the 3 month rains retreat. We've had 3 weeks of rain, and I don't know that we've all become monks, but I think that we all became mushrooms. In recognition of this time, which marks out how cyclical our lives are, our lives seem to be stitched into time cycles, and so we're always made aware of the passing of time, getting older, getting in touch with our vulnerability, getting in touch with how precious it is. Is this better? Okay. Too much of my breath. Okay. Too much breath. Never. Okay, here, better? It's been 2.5 weeks since I started a cold, so my voice is a little raspy. I apologize. What an incredible opportunity it is to be alive. So whenever we feel weighed down and burdened by the cyclical nature of how we measure ourselves in time and space, we can reframe it and appreciate this momentous miracle of being present in this state that we call being alive, which is just a state. In the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, the states after we die are called bardos. They're disembodied states that the spirit moves through. And recently, in modern times, the Tibetans have realized that being alive is a bardo too. So we have a body which helps us orient in time and space, gives us definition, gives us personality and a sense of self. But it's all a bardo in the sense that it's passing, it's transitory, and it's very, very illusory. So, no reason to hang on to it, but a lot of reason to appreciate this moment in this bardo with this body. And it occurred to me this evening while we were sitting quietly, I heard a lot of people sighing into their position. Ah, like, oh my goodness, it feels good. And, or at least it's a relief. And if not a good relief, at least it is a refuge. It is a refuge from the impingement of all the infinite sensory impact that happens to us from moment to moment. And we have the rare and treasured opportunity to drop into just being with ourselves. And even though we hold ourselves very preciously and are afraid that we're going to disappear any minute and fear that we might disappear when we die, we have a tendency to not give ourselves the quality of attention and presence that preciousness would invite us to do. So when we sit together or alone, but especially together, because it's a powerful way to practice being part of a group, we have the opportunity to drop into and be present and become comfortable with whatever we explore and discover in our mind and body and heart process. From moment to moment, a real gift of presence to ourselves. The most generous gift that we can give to ourselves in this time of gift giving and of generosity. And when we drop into being present with ourselves, we have the challenge of noticing things. Our minds are going a certain place. We have certain feelings in our bodies. We have certain emotions in our hearts. And the trick, the meditative trick, the secret is to accept what we discover from moment to moment. Instead of contracting, instead of resisting, being critical, saying, oh no, this isn't the right thing that I'm supposed to be experiencing at this moment. It's too painful, it's uncomfortable, it's too hateful. The trick is to just be with it. Oh, I'm in hatred. Oh, my knees hurt. Oh, my mind won't get quiet. Or, oh, I feel very expansive and peaceful. And all the infinite varieties that we can explore when we give ourselves a moment to be with ourselves. After all, what's more important? So myself in my body, I notice that I carry a lot of tension in my shoulders and my shoulder blades, the upper part of my back. And it's so easy on noticing to say, ah, and just let it roll off, just let it go. My body doesn't fall apart. I don't fall apart. Life continues, and the next breath arises and then recedes just naturally. Even if I'm not supporting whatever it is that my shoulders and back are trying to hold up. I used to say it's my tits, but it's other things now. Many, many, many things accumulate as we have the experience we call being alive. So I always treasure the opportunity to come here and to be supported in my practice, in my willingness to be present with myself. And I've noticed lately that, you know, just the simple anapanasati practice of attending to the ebb and flow of breathing is a great lesson in generosity, abundance, and letting go. So in my practice lately, that's what I've settled into. I notice when I take a deep breath, the air is continuous. It never stops. There's an abundance of oxygen. The more relaxed I get, the more expansive my rib cage is, the more air I can breathe in. There isn't a moment when the air stops and says, stop, you've had enough. This is all you're going to get with this breath. So it's a direct, immediate, and profound experience of absolute abundance. And then I let it go. Totally, completely. The out-breath is as important as the in-breath. And the reason that I'm willing to let it go so completely is because I have absolute trust that when I take a breath again, the air will be there again for me. So I try to generalize that to the rest of my life, having a more open-hearted, open-handed perspective towards being present from moment to moment. If there's something that I love the taste of, I'm willing to swallow it and let it go, knowing there's going to be more food, there's going to be more deliciousness, or my eyes contact something of utter beauty. I realize if I have to turn away from it, or I have to walk out of the museum, I can come back. There is an abundance of sensory experience. Everything that sustains beingness is abundant. It's only the things that sustain personality that are limited. And if we are in that contracted personality state, white-knuckling everything, trying to control, trying to manage, then we're in a state of feeling the lack, the potential lack of things, the poverty. And this is a period in the year, in this dark cycle we call the solstice, that is a celebration of generosity. In the darkest time, what we can do is practice being light. That's what all the lights are about in the trees and the houses and the windows. That's what the Hanukkah story is about. 8 candles, celebrating that there was enough oil for the 8 nights, even though the temple had been burned down to the ground and there was a terrible, terrible war going on. There was abundance even in that state. So we have everything that we need to be present and to be light with ourselves from moment to moment. The only thing required to fully apprehend that is the willingness to be present with ourselves. In quiet, turning everything off, not having stimulus come in all the time, not being distracted, but being easeful and comfortable about just being with ourselves. It's a great gift of generosity, not only to ourselves, but it helps how we are with other people, other creatures, other beings, the infinite beings that are formed and formless appreciate us when we practice. And it's good to remember that we have the capacity to attain absolute liberation. That inside, the seed inside of our being is the Buddha. And when we drop in and are present with ourselves, we are watering that seed. It is growing. And we can experience it in our lives. As a result of practice, we're nicer. We slow down a little bit. We become gentler. We're gentler to ourselves. We're gentler to other people. We feel their pain. We have more empathy, more compassion, more desire to help each other be happier, feel more abundant. I'm sure that the reason that you're here tonight is because you have experienced the fruits of practice. Because there's nothing about the Dharma experience that requires faith. All that it requires is the absolute feedback of immediate and direct experience. And so the very fact that we're sitting here tonight is a demonstration to ourselves that we feel the fruits of the practice and we want to water that inner seed a little more. There was a student once who was in a group that was led by a Tibetan teacher named Chogyam Trungpa, who asked him, "What is enlightenment?" And Trungpa said, "Enlightenment is a totally experimental attitude towards life." So what does that mean? An experimental attitude towards life. It means that from moment to moment, even though we have so much experience and our pattern-seeking minds have created lots of generalizations and truths, we live as if every next breath is a mystery, that we don't know what will happen. Even though whether we're awake or asleep, we're always breathing. Every single next breath is a mystery, a sensory exploration. Every single next moment that we experience being alive is a mystery, an exploration into the unknown, an experimental attitude towards life, letting go of what we think we know, being fresh, round-eyed, open-hearted, and available for experience to touch us. And that is the antidote to feeling old. Just in case some of us do feel that these days. So since we're a smaller group and more intimate, I want to give you an opportunity to share your questions, your own wisdom, your stories in the group. Don't be shy. Everything is acceptable. You don't have to edit. Just take this time to share who you are at this moment when you drop in and are comfortable just being present with yourselves. It's been such a quiet evening. And even the motorcycle, just realized right now, it's the very first time this evening. Usually the motorcycles are whipping around this block all through the meditation. It's been very supportive and quiet. And it's been very quiet in the room, except for an occasional sneeze or cough. Yes. Me too. Clearing, clearing, clearing. So, what's up? Yes, Linda.
An observation that I'm sitting, I was noticing, that lost in thought, and then came back in, and then lost in thought, and then came back in, and goes over and over and over. And I was just noticing like a little something unpleasant about coming back in, because you're still, I know that that's what the mind does.
The relief of what?
Pardon?
The relief, noticing the relief of?
The relief of turning toward what seems unpleasant.
Uh-huh. Okay. 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 Thank you. We are highly, highly judgmental critters. And it is a source of suffering for us to be in judgment all of the time. Because it's a continual, contractive state of being in judgment. You know, it's kind of like we get that fold on top of our nose between our eyes, except that it's all through our being. So the only thing to do in those situations is to have compassion for ourselves, because it's just conditioned. You know, we are conditioned to try to be good. Good, good, good. Good meditators, good people, good students, good husbands, good wives, good citizens. And it's not our fault. It's just confronting our conditioning. So when we confront the pain that our conditioning causes, what a great opportunity to say, oh, it's all right. That's just a moment of compassion. Thank you. Thank you. I think about, you know, how a comedic, spoofy film can be accused of being a terrorist attack, you know. And I think, my God, you know, poor, what's his name, Kim Jong-un. He's got to be, it's got to be really, really painful being what shall we call him? A tyrannical leader. If a funny movie can threaten him so much that he considers it a terrorist attack. So we're not quite there, but we do feel attacked by a lot of things that aren't really, really malevolent, including our own minds. So we can express and feel compassion for him because he's truly trapped in his need to be in control of everything. I guess we all have a little bit of Kim Sung-un inside of ourselves. We feel, you know, if a car goes by too fast in front of us, it's a form of terrorism. So just to be able to relax and get to a place of expansive, spacious acceptance with whatever we find from moment to moment, when we settle in being with ourselves, that, to me, is a liberated state, is a state of enlightenment. That's right. Just sighing and accepting and being with what is true in this moment. What is it that Howie says? Just this breath, just this moment. It's all that we've got. Might as well enjoy it. Swimmingly.
Yvonne, we spoke earlier of one of the things that I've gotten involved in, and that is reading the obits.
Yes.
I'm at an age.
Who died today?
Who died today? Yes.
It's quite a mental hobby.
It is. And to realize that there's a beginning, middle, and an end, you know, and I'm towards the end now. And it's always fascinating to me to wake up, to sit, to do meditation. Oh, it's been a few more breaths, you know.
You have a few more breaths inside
This bardo, yes. Yeah. And the dance continues. So.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that is really, really a relief about the practice is it allows us to drop out of the time cycles. I noticed, you know, when I started practice, I was 24 years old, and now I'm 69. And I realize when I get into that place inside of myself, I feel timeless. You know, it was a timeless place when I was 24, because when you're 24, you feel you're too young for things, right? And when you're in your 60s, you feel like, oh, I'm getting too old for things. When you drop into that place, time goes away, and there's a kind of resilience. It's kind of like the fresh greenness of self emerges. And it's a beautiful, timeless, ageless place. And it's a great relief. from these cycles that torment us. I'm sitting here looking at this clock, this round clock, hour after hour, moment after moment, day after day. What a trap! What an imprisoning thing. When really, our being is outside of time. Space might exist, but time is something that we created and that we torment ourselves with. So I notice myself that when I practice, I drop out of that time frame. I'm no longer in cyclical drive. It's part of the liberation. Yeah. How to stay here in the modern world. You think that the modern world is different?
How do you stay in that state in time when you drop in?
Yes.
And because I've been there, it's wonderful, and then you have to walk out the door.
Yes.
And people aren't interacting that way.
And people don't interact that way. That's what I mean by the impinging of others and allowing oneself to be conditioned by that, when really we don't have to be that way. I think part of our illusory system tells us that if we are in that state when we walk out the door, we won't survive. We'll be in danger. You know, we won't be competent. I work with people who work in organizations, and I try to convince them that they will survive in the working world without having to be defended, without having to be truncated, without getting to the lowest common denominator of their optimal selves. Because that's what happens when we let go of that place. We don't realize that that place is actually the most powerful place to be. Because whatever comes at us, we have extraordinary spacious resources and choices about how we respond, even if we respond. So I think it's good to remember, to remind ourselves that this space actually is appropriate for anywhere, everywhere, all the time, and it doesn't weaken us. It actually makes us stronger. In a non-brittle kind of a way. You know what I mean? I think a lot of the occlusions that happen, you know, the contractive, darkening occlusions that happen in our lives are defensive structures. And we don't need them. We don't need them. We're stronger the less defended we are. Being in defensive contraction takes a lot of energy because you have to hold these patterns. You know, oh, here comes so-and-so. I'm going to, you know, or I have to do this now. Or I'm going out in the street and it's cold, so the body goes into contraction, which means all the veins get narrower, you don't have as much oxygen, so you get colder, just by definition. We're stronger when we're in this state. We don't need all our defenses. Life is not that dangerous. Other people are not that dangerous.
Let's take, for example, women walk differently in the world. Have to walk differently in the world.
Yes, but they don't have to be with themselves differently. Yeah. And I'm not sure that...
It is kind of schizophrenic.
It's schizophrenic?
I guess the marriage of, you know, there is caution, you know. I'm wondering if you can women as an example, but, you know, we do live in a patriarchal culture that looks at women differently.
Yes, but, you know... And it's true, it's not to turn away from the truths of the conditions of the world, but if we take them on and then react to them, we're actually reconditioning it. We're actually reconditioning it. So I see it with, I have a new dog, and I see if he approaches another dog with a little bit of anxiety because of the size of the dog, he gets into the state, he conditions the other dog to become aggressive. So that's the way we condition through projection, you know? So it's, you know, managing is a subtle dance, but we do it better when we're centered. We do it better when we're outside of the time-space continuum. We have infinite resources available to us inside of us. Don't believe me, try it on and see. If you come in tattered and, you know, tormented next week for having tried it, I will apologize.
No, I'm just thinking of then where did blaming the victim, I mean, if you look at Michael Brown, you know, was he walking a certain way?
But, you know, this state is not a weak state. I don't feel weak.
I agree, but I'm just saying, if he wasn't in, so maybe he wasn't in touch, and then...
None of those people were in touch. I don't think any of them were very in touch with themselves. Ignorance does cause a lot of harm. A lot of harm. Yes. Yes. You know, part of the tradition of mindfulness was picked up and perfected by the warrior classes because it's seen as such a powerful place to move through even when you're in combat. So it's not a weak space, and you don't lose yourself, and you don't increase your vulnerability. But you have a better time.
I understand.
Mm-hmm. I know.
You're just
trying to rescue me from the silence. I understand, and I appreciate it. Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you. I do. Yeah. No, I don't do that. I don't do that. I just let it go. I just notice and I let it go. I don't do that. Not with my body. My poor body, it's working so well for me. You know, I don't want to hassle it with that stuff. I realize that it's my mind. My body is responding to my mind, and my mind is contracted around having to carry stuff. It's not my mind's fault either. But it's very interesting to notice the body responding to our mental states. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Exactly. That's, or even trying to change it. You know, oh, this is where I am in the moment. I'm in hatred. You know, I mean, I've caught myself in violent hatred. You know, what to do? Where to go when you're in violent hatred? I mean, you know, can't go to Miami Beach. I mean, what are you going to do? But the acceptance changes it. The problem with this work is that it's called spiritual. And the moment that we think we're doing something spiritual, our conditioning brings up all the demands of being a good kid, you know, a good practitioner, a good follower, you know, doing it right. And that is so aligned with the conditions of being a good person. You know, all the conditions that happen when we grow up, the school, the parents, the contractions, the conformity of things. And really, it's good to be good, but it depends on where that goodness arises from. If you're good because you want something, you know, notice, you know, a lot of times, I've been so good, you know, what good did it do me to be good? You know, and I think that it really, it's a very subtle entrapment when we do spiritual work, that all those conditions of shoulds really come to the foreground. And we can just melt them away by noticing them. So when our mind comes back and we wake up in that moment that our mind has been traveling somewhere, the fact that we're coming back means that we woke up. And that's really what Buddha means. It's the awakened one. And in a very, very small but significant way, that is the awakening that he's talking about. So it's a moment of congratulation, really. Because we can be asleep and engaged in thoughts forever, right? Even when we go to sleep, real sleep at night, the dreams keep the whole thing going, you know. And every moment that we say, oh, well, where did I go? And here, but here I am back, is an enlightened moment to be congratulated, treasured. All that the mind does is what it's been conditioned to do. Poor mind. So, what to do? What to do? We can even have a sense of humor and laugh about it because it goes into wild and crazy places and it thinks that it's really helping us out. That's the funniest part of it. But thank you. Yeah. Yeah, we don't have to be good students, good practitioners, good Buddhists. We just need to be exactly what we are from moment to moment. It's a radical concept, but it is actually a liberation from social conditioning. And a lot of what my generation of people were interested in when they went into practice, when we went into practice, was liberation from the conditioning of our society and our culture and our schools and our families. And then the ultimate liberation was like way out there someplace, you know. But the ultimate liberation is every little moment that you wake up and come back to being present. And it stacks up. I like to think of it as watering the seed of Buddha. We're all Buddhas. I congratulate all of us. We don't have to climb the mountain. It's not hard work in the salt mines. It's really just letting go. Like we let go of the breath completely. Just let go completely. Everything that we've learned that is valuable is operating. I like to think it's in our hard drive. We don't have to remind ourselves of it. It's all operating. Our bodies are like animals, learning incredibly how to survive. We don't have to use our minds for that. Our minds are useful for problem solving, for sure. We can strategize. We can create patterns. That's what the mind does. It's a pattern-seeking missile. And that somewhere down the road becomes a worry-seeking missile. I just noticed, I swore up and down, if it ever stops raining, I'm going to be so blissful. These last 2 days have been beautiful. I was blissful for the first 3 hours, and then I forgot. So, you know, there's other things that come up. Okay, the sun is out, but there's always things to worry about. The mind is always busy worrying. Poor mind. Poor mind. And the more we share with other people where our minds go, the more we realize our minds are all kind of going in the same places. So is it my mind? Or is it the mind? And it helps to understand that the things that torment us torment everybody. We're all suffering similar internal states a lot of the time. And realizing that is a foundation for real compassion. And the possibility of experiencing and exploring non-self, not self. The mind is not self. The mind is something that has developed over eons of time. And DNA is very impersonal. And we're much more similar to each other than we're different. And that is also a good reason to not have fear when we're together. We can let go of our defensiveness. That is generally the, you know, my understanding of true happiness is dropping defensive structures. And it is 9 o'clock. So let's just sit together for a few more minutes before we disperse. And practice gratitude. Gratitude to ourselves for having entered this practice. Gratitude for each other in sharing and supporting our practice by being together every week. Gratitude to those teachers that have given instruction and invitation and inspiration over the millennia in all the various traditions that all point to the same seed of light and truth. And gratitude in recognition for this moment when we feel whatever it is that we feel, just as it is. Thank you, and I will be here next week.